What are those management principles that seem, and how would they seem they might operate in the church? And that's what this is all about, really. And that's what we're going to talk about, and most of it will be attached to the particular outline that you have here. Now, church management, there's all kinds of definitions, as you would expect, whatever people think management is. It's leadership, administrations, it's a strategy, planning strategy, implementing it, it's problem solving, all kinds of things like that. It's organizing, and it's notable to know, it's noteworthy to see that already in the Old Testament in Exodus, why Jethro got together with his son-in-law Moses and told him something about organizing. Management is, I think, finally, when we talk about it as far as the church is concerned, is taking God's resources and using them to accomplish his purposes. And of course, the outside of his own word and sacraments, the greatest resources the Lord gives us are people. And that's what management in the church is all about, really, is using God's resources to accomplish his purpose, that is, God's purpose in this whole thing. And then, what in the world is a manager? Well, a manager is the guy who does the managing. And when we talk about this in workshops around the country, we generally say that anybody who has a piece of the church's management is then a manager, whether that's the pastor or the custodian or the elder or the chairman of the women's guild or whatever it is, because each of these people have a piece of the church's management. And so they are, in effect, managers in the church. A manager is a person who manages and leads. He might be called a leader, an officer, an executive, an administrator, a boss, a chairman, a committeeman, a board member, whatever it is. Managers aren't born leaders. And pastors, as you heard this morning in Dr. Lutke's presentation, there seems to be a real tension just in the fact of their professional life or professional orientation and this business of management, as we sometimes think of it as relating to business opportunities. So managers are not born leaders. They're made, but they're not self-made either. They're made and they develop on the basis of what happens to them in a community or in a Christian community, the congregation. There's no set of characteristics which will name a person as a, or mark a person as a manager. You can't look at a little baby in the crib and say, aha, there's a kid who's going to grow up and be a good manager, you see. It just doesn't happen that way. And when you ask lay people about this kind of a thing, you get strange answers, too, just as you do when you ask pastors. What is a good pastor? Well, everybody seems to know what they mean by a good pastor and a good congregation, but by whose definition? That they never really ever know. But one of the things that always seems to creep up in this, and this is what the other two speakers were saying too, is that somehow attached to that is that he has the ability to lead, to administer, whatever that general idea may be, and that he has a kind of a pattern of success. I think Dr. Lutke said it this morning, that somewhere along the line it does show up that the pastor who is marked as successful seems always to be a good administrator. Well, anyway, managers are builders, they're implementers, they're innovators, they're kind of a drama director. That's why I was interested again in what he termed, what was it he called, he said they're synthesizers, or they're a kind of a pastoral director. And that's really what a good manager in the church affairs is. He's a kind of a drama director, an innovator, a director. Managers are judged by the people they lead, just as good teachers are judged by the people that they have or the pupils, how they work and how they act. A manager, finally, is that kind of a person who can take the goals and purposes of an organization, in this case, the congregation or the church, more correctly, the church, and the hopes, fears, aspirations, purposes, and goals of people, and weld them together in such a way that both are satisfied, both the goals of the organization are satisfied, and then the goals of the individual. Well, that's just a quick way by introduction. I really wanted to say in the beginning, forgot to, that whatever we say, we try to preface it by two or three things. One is that in the Christian congregation, the pastor is the chief administrator. We really believe that, and we say that. And we say it unabashedly, despite the fact that we know that that immediately raises the hair on the backs of the necks of both pastors and people. Pastors don't like to hear this in many instances because of this professionalism that Dr. Lucky was talking about. After all, you are pastors. They're pastors. You have things to do like preaching and counseling and handling the spiritual affairs of people. And you are not, by the nature of your task or your duties or anything else, supposed to be concerned about such things as money in a congregation and who does what and all of this. These are things we're not to be bothered with. This is the way a lot of pastors react to it. A lot of lay people don't like to hear a statement like that either, that pastors are the chief administrators in a congregation, because after all, they're the kingpins. After all, we've got guys like chairmen of congregations and boards of elders and people like that who like to think that they're running the congregation and that preacher isn't going to run the affairs of our congregation. After all, we're businessmen, and the church ought to be run like a business. These are the kinds of things you hear. Well, the truth of the matter is, nevertheless, that the pastor is the chief administrator. He is the one person around which everything finally revolves. In the Lutheran Layman's League or any other organization, we always know that finally, in the final analysis, you have to convince the pastor, or you have to go to the pastor, or most often the information that you need comes from the pastor. There's a saying that no congregation rises above the level of its pastor. The inverse of that is also true, that no pastor rises above the level of his congregation, for that matter, too. But the point is that the pastor is the chief administrator. He's the one person that ought to know the most about that congregation. And just by the very fact that he is whom he is, he's the chief administrator. He's the guy that people come to when they have troubles. He's the guy they first go to if the boiler breaks down, or the organ doesn't work, or the toilet's over flooding, or the basement, there's water in the basement, or the bell doesn't ring, or anything else. If they've got a parish school and the kids from that parish school are cutting across some lady's lawn, they, 9 times out of 10, they don't go to the principal with it, or certainly not to the parents. They'll yell at the kids, but they'll call the preacher, the parish priest, the preacher, and complain to him about it. So everything revolves about the pastor, whether he likes it that way or not. And so he is the chief administrator. The problem, as I started to say, is that neither pastor nor people understand the concept of what administration or what management is. I remember talking about this in Austin one time, and a pastor argued with me pretty strongly about this, and then he proceeded to tell me what was going on in his congregation, that he didn't have to worry about this kind of a thing and this kind of a thing because so-and-so was doing this. And what it ended up, he was telling everybody what a good administrator he was, because that's what administration is, seeing that these things are delegated to the right people and that they're being done. And then this is what administration is, seeing that people are plugged in to the various tasks which are needed to be done in a congregation and that they are getting done. The second premise is that in every given congregation, in any given congregation, there are those people. There are that number of people, that's what I want to say. There are that number of people. The Lord has put that number of people in any given congregation that are necessary to accomplish the tasks. Now, of course, this is not a very popular statement either. An officer of the English district some years ago made a little compilation of, he gets all of the papers from the parishes, and he made a tabulation of all of the complaints that pastors made in these parish papers. And they usually ended up like this. There aren't enough Sunday school teachers. There aren't enough people in the choir. There aren't enough people to fill the offices, particularly at that awful time of the year when we are supposed to elect officers. There's never enough people around for candidates. And of course, there's never enough money. These are always the problems. These are always the problems. They sum up to this, there aren't enough people involved in this whole thing. There aren't enough people committed. And then what happens, the next thing that happens so often is that we start this hand-wringing bit, you know. One pastor will say, oh, if I just had the kind of people that you have in your parish, or I wish my people were as dedicated as you. Well, the lay people say this too, you see. Well, we got a bunch of dumbheads over here. They just never do anything. I can't see why they can't get excited like those people over there. They just don't love the Lord. They aren't dedicated enough. If we just had more consecrated people, that's the kind of speeches that are usually made. But I think we must start with the premise that there are in any given congregation that number of people placed there by the Lord to accomplish the tasks which are needed to be done in that congregation. And of course, with that goes that there are people who do love the Lord and who are ready to serve Him. Now, of course, the problem is, how do we find those people? How do we find these people? And how do we turn them on? And that's where this whole business of management principles comes in then. There are five management principles as we list them here, or really a four. One is a subheading of another. I suppose the previous speakers who really know something about management and business operation might say, you'd organize this in some different way. Maybe they would. I don't know. But anyway, we went about it this way. The first management principle, which operates in business, government, the academic world, or any place else, is defining your purposes. Know why you exist. And this is what ought to happen in the church. People ought to know why the church exists. But they don't. They don't. And you can understand, if they don't really understand why the church is there, that all of this other stuff really doesn't make much sense. You can't plan if you don't have any purposes. There's no need of organizing anything, really, to accomplish any task if you don't know what your purpose is. Now, this may seem strange, I'm sure, that you start out by saying a great many people in the church don't know what the purpose of the church is. But I do believe this. Unfortunately, you ask any lay group of people, what is the purpose of your church? And most of the time, after a little bit of study, they'll come up with to preach the Word of God in its truth and purity, or something like that, to go out and witness for Christ. And of course, these things are all true. But if you work with them a little bit more and question them a little bit more, they can't go beyond that. They can't go beyond that. They don't see the church as serving in the community or serving people in the church. And so many times we begin to ask them questions, well, and why do you have a school? Or why do you have a Sunday school? Or I usually tell them, if you really believe that to teach and preach the Word of God in its truth and purity is the only real purpose of the church, or the major purpose of the church, and you can't think of anything else, then why don't we just buy everybody a transistor radio and give out radios to everybody, and then have some great radio preacher preach, because after all, then we would be accomplishing the task, wouldn't we? Preach the Word of God in its truth and purity. Well, then they begin to think, oh yeah, there are other things that we ought to do in the church. So, as a manager in a church, and the chief manager in a church, the task of the pastor, I think, is to help people understand what the church is all about. To to get them to think about what its purposes are, what its objectives are. And then goals, of course, are just little short-range things. And you don't often see this. I can think of two or three congregations that at the beginning of a fiscal year or the new year, they actually publish a kind of a listing of the goals for the year. But most congregations don't. There's a congregation in the city right now is calling a pastor, and the pastor who was called met with the council, and his first question out of the box was, what do you think your congregation ought to do? And his next question was, how are you organized to accomplish the tasks? And that council was just terribly embarrassed, because on both accounts they couldn't really give a satisfactory answer. Pastor didn't accept that call either. Maybe he rattled them a little bit. Well, so anyway, the first management principle is defining purposes, actually defining the purposes. What ought we be doing? And the next principle, management principle, is that one of planning. If you have goals and purposes in one thing or another, but you never plan to accomplish those goals and those tasks, nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. In business, of course, you got to do this, and people understand this, in the academic world, in the government, in the world of the government. But in the church, we just don't do this. Precious little planning ever goes on. The most planning that seems to go on in congregations is probably around budget time, and it revolves around about the budget. And it's usually something like this. Here's a list of what we spent last year, and here's what we think we can spend this year. Now let's see. The choir had $100 in the budget last year, but they only spent $75. Good, we can cut that. Let's cut it to $75 this year. That's about as much planning as goes on. And who does the planning in the congregation? Is it supposed to be the board of elders? Is it the church council? The board of elders doesn't seem to have time. They rush in, you know, and they've got to make these delinquent calls, which is a bad name in a sense itself, you know. But we've got to make all of these delinquent calls. And so we call ourselves together, and then we pick up our cards and we make these delinquent calls. And maybe we'll talk about the pastor's salary and whether we ought to clean the church a little better and whether the ushers are doing their job and things like that. But not a great deal of planning goes on. We never seem to have time for it. Never have seen the time for it. We're always just at the point of putting out fires or taking care of all kinds of little emergencies. We haven't planned for the fact that the roof might blow off, or the furnace might blow up, or the organ may not work, and so we've got these little problems always bubbling up, you see. Or the pastor gets sick and we've never ever thought about what would happen if, you see. All of these kinds of things. So precious little planning really ever goes on in the congregation, and we're not going to spend a lot of time today talking about that, except to say that this is one of the management principles which ought to apply to the church and doesn't really apply. Maybe you want to ask after a while, who's supposed to do this and how do you go about it? But a quick for instance. Mr. Heinz was just talking about, in fact, that's what he was, in this planning process, ought to go all of these things that he was talking about. We ought to plug in with as much information as we can. We ought to know as much about our congregation as we can. We can't very well plan unless we know something about our congregation. And some congregations, of course, I can think of one congregation who built a nice church, and 2 years later, along came an interstate highway and just about tore all of the property away from that congregation, from that building. No one had ever thought to think or ask the community fathers or whoever has to be asked about these things the possibility of such a thing happening. On the other hand, I remember being at a little congregation out of Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and I went to a little church and the pastor, I thought to myself, yeah, this is surely typical Missouri Synod style, you see. We find a little piece of property as far away from everything as we can possibly find it and build a church. But this pastor and his people knew what was going to happen. He took me out in the back and he showed me some hills in that area, and he said, in 5 years, this will all be populated. And they knew why they were there. And they knew how much property they needed and what they were going to do in that community. They were planning. In our own congregation one time, we decided, as Mr. Hines was just saying, for instance, one of the ways to find out these things, we just decided we were going to have a meeting some night. We're going to split the congregation in half, and we're going to have them on two Sunday nights. Half the congregation come on one Sunday night and half on the other. And we're only going to have two things on the agenda. That we're going to ask, what do you think our congregation is doing well in this community, and what do you think it's not doing well? We got quite a bit of surprise out of that. The first surprise was that people came. You know, again, we always think, well, people aren't really interested in talking about these things. But people did come. Husbands and wives came. Teenagers came. A man that I know of as Catholic wife, his wife even came to this meeting. That was the first surprise. The second surprise was they did talk intelligently about the things they thought we were doing well and the things that we weren't doing well. And we got them all nicely laid out and categorized and talked about it, but nobody had planned what to do with the information. That's what Don Heinz is saying, you see. It just sort of became information that we got, but no one had planned how it was to be used. And to this day, nothing really has ever come of it, except that board. It was channeled to different boards in the congregation who seemed that they might take care of it. Well, the next management principle that we ought to be concerned about is that of organizing. And organizing is that, or you might call it, it's the people amplifier. We've got our goals, we've done our planning, now we've got to we've got to find out what the tasks are, and then fit the people, plug the people into those particular tasks. So the next thing in this organizing is we ought to determine what the tasks are. Unfortunately, tradition, constitutions lots of times, things like that, have already sort of determined what we think the tasks ought to be in a congregation, and we never seem to be able to do anything else. But if we could only start at it in a fresh way, and here are our goals, this is the way we plan to accomplish it, now these are the tasks that need to be done. We need somebody to take care of the young people. Maybe we don't. But maybe we need a youth ministry. We need to do something with the children in our congregation. We've got a lot of them that are of school age. We've got over here a great number of people. As one of the speakers said this morning, we've got a segmented congregation, really. Well, then we ought to plan now. What are the tasks needed to accomplish the ministry for this group of people and that group of people and this? We need money. So, of course, we've got to have some sort of a stewardship effort. Stewardship, of course, should be more than just money. But anyway, we determine the tasks. And with this should be the whole business of writing job descriptions, which again is something, of course, which we take for granted in business and industry, government and the like. We rarely ever do this in a congregation. The best that's ever done is probably some general statements are made about what the task, what a person should do in conjunction with the Constitution. But we really ought to develop job descriptions, and if we have nothing at all, maybe we ought to start with the people that we have, although job descriptions should never really be written for people. They should be written for the task. But maybe we ought to just start with the Board of Elders and say, what do you think your task is? Put it down on paper, let's discuss it, and start from there. But anyway, we ought to determine the tasks and develop job descriptions in a pretty careful way. And now then, find the people to fit the jobs. And this really probably is the toughest business of the church manager. The church manager. To select and match people to the tasks. So much of it is done in a slipshod way. People get elected in this way most often. Or they get appointed. Let's see, it's a congregational meeting, and let's see, we need some guy to do something. We need some man to do Sunday school superintendent work. And so we say, now let's see, George, you haven't been doing very much in the congregation lately. You haven't been in office for about 4 years now. I think it's time you work. How about you taking it? Well, the guy would like to stand up and scream and say, I don't want your old job, but he's a gentleman, so he doesn't say anything, and he's it for the next 2 or 3 years. He's Mark It. And that's about all the effort he ever puts in his job. That's all the effort he really ever puts in his job. Or we recruit a Sunday school superintendent, something like this, the Board of Education, it's their task to do this. They go to some poor soul and they say, we need a Sunday school superintendent. So-and-so moved out or he got tired or he died or something. We need somebody else to be Sunday school superintendent. How would you like to have the job? It doesn't take much of your time. That's about the way we generally go at it, you see. It doesn't take much of your time. We got a good program. We got Mission Life now and things like that, you know. Lots of interesting teachers. And maybe you take the guy out and buy him a beer or something and try and convince him. And finally he says, yeah, I'll do it. And then 2 Sundays later he discovers that the Sunday school superintendent really means things like this. That no one has bothered to set up any of the chairs. The Sunday school superintendent, the materials weren't ordered. Half the teachers come late and the other half don't come at all. And then on top of all of that, a little girl vomits in the nursery room and it's his job to clean that mess up on the job, part of the job too. Well, in about 6 months he's had it and he quits, or what usually happens, he doesn't quit, but he doesn't do anything. And so there we are. We're stuck with a superintendent. No attempt to match a person's abilities with this task. No attempt to motivate him. No one has even really told him what his job is, because no job description has ever been made. How much easier it would be to go to a man and say, look, Fred, we need a Sunday school superintendent. We've looked around the congregation and we think you're the best qualified man we have. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but we promise to help you all we can, and here's what we need and want a Sunday school superintendent to do. Now study this over and talk it over with your wife and pray about it, and next Wednesday night we're going to come over and we're going to talk to you a little bit about it, and we want you really to see how you might fit into this task. Now, if a man says yes, you've really got him. You've got him because he knows what his job is. He's accepted that job. And now if things go wrong, you've got some control right away. You can say to him, how come? How come this isn't getting done? Didn't you agree to do this? And all of that kind of stuff, you see. But most of the time, we don't bother with that, you see. And then back to this business of selecting people and matching them to the tasks that need to be done. This, of course, presupposes that we know people and we know what motivates them. Now, I want you to know and understand that I understand that it is the Holy Spirit which is the prime mover in everything connected with the church. I know that it is the Holy Spirit who finally moves people, and not finally, first moves people to do these things. That they do love the Lord and the like. But by the same token, there are human needs, values, roles, the way people handle conflict and decision, the way they handle praise and punishment, the way they handle success and frustration, all of these things about people that makes them do the kinds of things that they do. Business knows this. Government knows this. Industry uses these kinds of things to match people up with the tasks. But in the church, we suddenly seem to forget it all. And we simply say, he's a Christian, therefore he can fit into every task that we want him to. And they don't, and they won't. We ought to know something about a person's needs. Something about a person's needs. Maslow, he developed the hierarchy of needs. First physiological needs, and then on up the ladder. Well, if we would know some of these things about people, we might know where they should fit into a congregation. Take the man, for instance, who's the janitor of the local high school. Now, whatever name you give him, call him a sanitary engineer or whatever it is, he still knows he's a janitor. And he knows that doesn't rate very high on the priority of what people think in a community. On the other hand, we have a man who's the chairman of Monsanto in our congregation. We logically think that the man who is chairman of Monsanto is the guy who ought to be the chairman of our congregation and really run this thing like a business. This is what lay people will say too, you see. And we're disappointed to find that this man doesn't do a very good job at all as the chairman of the congregation. One of the reasons could be that he doesn't really find any self-satisfying in this whole business. He finds no need for this kind of a thing. After all, this is what he does all the time. And we're surprised that a man like this is content to sing in the choir, or maybe even be an usher, or something like that. We use his lesser skills. But then suddenly we find out that this man who's a janitor, with a little bit of prodding and help and direction, makes a great chairman of a congregation. And maybe the reason is because he has a need which is satisfied by being chairman of a congregation. He finally feels like he amounts to something when he can sort of direct the affairs of a congregation. Well, there's all kinds of examples like this. But the point is, we really ought to endeavor to know what people's needs are, or their values. The values, the sum total of what a person thinks about himself and about everything that surrounds him, all by himself, when he's all alone. What does he really think? If we knew this about people, we would know how this would fit into a given situation. Or the roles that he plays. What kind of a person is he when the pastor is around? What kind of a person is he when his mother-in-law is around? What kind of a person is he when his wife is around, or when she isn't around, or the like? I once worked in a congregation where a man always got angry. He was a member of a board of parish education. He always got angry. Well, he was so consistent in the role that he played that we could live with it. We just finally waited until he blew his top and went home, and then we went on with our business, you see. Needless to say, he wasn't reelected, however. But he played a very consistent role. But we ought to know these things. To whom does a person defer? I know a congregation, for instance, where there is an older man, old John I always call him, and he has 7 strapping sons, all good, strong people with their own families and all good in business and everything else. And yet, when you come into a congregational meeting, all of these people defer to old John. This byplay goes on in a congregational meeting, you know. Everybody sort of wants, well, they know what they ought to say, and they'd like to say it, but they won't say it until old John gets up and has his say. And then everybody knows what to say. They all sort of defer to him. Many times it's the pastor. It works something like this. Everybody thinks, well, what do you think? Oh, I don't know. What do you think? Well, I don't know. What do you think? What do you think, pastor? And so the pastor rises to the occasion and tells him what he thinks. And then everybody else knows precisely what to say and do. Whether they like it or not, they do it, you see. But they defer. How does a person handle conflict and decision? How does he handle conflict and decision? What does he do? What steps does he go through to make a decision? You know, some people run away from things. Some people decide not to do anything. And that's a decision, as that little sign that we see around some churches. To decide is already a decision. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some people decide not to do anything. Some people decide to let somebody else do it, and it usually gets done. Some guys can't make any decisions. Some men, you know, they can't buy a tie alone. Let the old woman do that. Or my wife makes all of those decisions. Or my wife does all of that, you see. And the congregation, it works the same way. Let George do it. Well, how do people handle praise and punishment? And how do they react to praise and punishment? Well, they react great to my praise. I remember my father, who is to this day a very ordinary laborer. I remember years ago when I was a boy, he came home one noon and he said, "The pastor called me John." Well, he was surprised because he figured he was such a very ordinary person, there's no reason why the pastor ought to know him in the first place. Second place, the pastor even knew his name. And ever after, my father, I think, would have rolled over and played dead for this pastor because of that. He thought he was a great guy, you see, and he would have done anything for him. People react to praise. We all react to praise. Now, praise differs from flattery. Praise is being genuinely interested in a person and being able to say something good about what they're accomplished. People react greatly to praise, but we don't use it in the congregation. In any way, we don't use it enough. We don't use it enough. Either to cause people to act, that is, to motivate them to act in a better way, or to be grateful for what they have done. Sunday school teachers go along wiping the noses of little kids all their life, and no one ever says anything to them. The organist plays 51 Sundays of a year, fine, but one Sunday he louses it up. That's when somebody tells him. It works the same way with pastors. You preach sermon after sermon, great. But the one Sunday you've been up the night before all night with a sick wife or a sick child or some other reason, and you aren't quite up to par, that's the day somebody will tell you, "Well, you weren't quite up to the day, were you, preacher?" Or something of the sort like that. Unfortunately, this is what we so often do in the church, you see. We unmotivate people. We make numb people of so many people by the things we say and do. But we all react to praise. All react to praise. I know a pastor who makes it he has a good church secretary, and that's a small chapter all by itself, the use of a good church secretary. In fact, she becomes probably, in some instances, the church manager, who has his church secretary every Monday morning just have about 5 or 10 calls lined up for him. He can't get around to make all of the calls, just to call people. And he makes it a point to be able to say something good about them and to them. "I saw you in church yesterday. You looked great." Or, "I saw this about your husband." Or, "I see that your son did so and so." Something nice, just something like that. Then the business of extrinsic motivators and intrinsic motivators. Do people react, and how do they react to extrinsic motivators? You know, in children, we give them stars for coming to Sunday school and things like that. We're getting away from that. We sort of poo-poo that. But does it work in the church yet for adults? And do people, are they motivated by extrinsic motivators? I think they are. I think even pastors are. At least you go into some pastors' offices and doctors' offices and lawyers' offices and you see all the certificates and awards. One thing or another, people are motivated by things like that. Now, all I wanted to say is that in order to select people and fit them more properly to the tasks, we need to know a lot of things about people. These are some of the things that we ought to try to know about them, how they react to these kinds of things. Of course, the next question is obvious. How in the world do you know this about people? How in the world do you know this about people? Well, how do you know anything about people? You've talked to them. You talk to them. I always remember that I was in Janesville, Wisconsin once, And I met one of the most interesting men I ever met in my life. I certainly won't ever forget him. He was an old man. I asked him what he did, and he said he didn't do nothing. Well, what did you do? Well, I raised rats. Well, I'll tell you, I had a fascinating half an hour talking to this man. What he did is he raised rats professionally for people, for laboratories and things like that. It's the only man I ever met in my life who raised rats. You find these things out about people by talking to them. And now I'm really talking to lay people as much as I am to pastors. Lay people, of course, this should be their responsibility. But you as the kingpin, the church manager, the chief administrator, you have to help people to know how to do these things. You have to construct opportunities where they get to talk to other people and where it becomes easy for them to do it. I think that in our congregations, we've almost purposely sometimes seem structured our whole church, our whole congregations now, so that people don't have much of a chance to meet each other anymore. You know, we have two services, so one half of the congregation never meets the other part of the congregation. We've ruled out bazaars and suppers and soup suppers and all those kinds of things. No, we really haven't. I noticed last week in the St. Louis Lutheran, there was a good half page of all of the sauerkraut suppers and whatnot all that are going on in this area. But, you know, we sort of poo-poo this kind of stuff. And then we even usher people out of church nowadays, you know. We want to do everything orderly, so we usher them out of church. And when do you get to meet anybody? I want to talk to Jake, and he's sitting three pews ahead of me. By the time I get ushered out, he's gone home, had dinner, laid down for the afternoon nap, and I never get to see him. So we've got to construct opportunities by which people can talk to each other and relate to each other and witness to each other and find out what your heartaches are and your gripes are and your joys are. I think we do. We've got to observe people. We've got to watch people. I always tell congregations, lay people, you know, they always, long about November of every year, they get awfully nervous. The nominating committee gets very nervous. Here they've got to come up with 28 candidates for 14 offices, and there's only 15 guys come to a congregational meeting. So what do? Now they get real nervous, you know, and this hand-wringing bit starts. And so they ask people, will you do this? And they say, no, won't do it. No, won't do it. And then, well, if they only were more dedicated. They just don't love the Lord like they used to and all of that kind of stuff. That's what we usually say. Well, that's far too late in November. They should be doing that all year long and observing. Aha, there's a young man that came into our congregation. I must make a point of knowing him. I want to know what his skills are. Let's see, how can we use him? What can we do about her? I think one of the strongest reasons for women being used in the church is because we aren't using the talents which they have. We aren't using the talent of many of the people in the church for that matter. We ask others about them. If you don't know them, then maybe somebody else does. And that's what ought to be get going for us in a Christian community. You know, we get together at these meetings and say, do you know somebody? Do you know this? What do you know about this guy? Yeah, this is what should be going on in a Christian congregation. But finally, we ought to find out what turns them on. What's their hot button, I like to say. What turns them on? I know a man in Wisconsin who always complains. No, he doesn't complain, but he's always apologizing for the fact that he never got beyond the eighth grade. And yet he's a super salesman. His wife and he will soon take a trip to Spain again because he's always winning free trips. He sells automobile parts. Oh, he doesn't really sell automobile parts at all. What he does is he walks into a store and he talks to a guy about, hey, I read about your son. He plays football at State University. He knows that this turns this guy on. For the next half an hour, this guy's talking about his son. And then he just sort of shoves it in a little bit later and says, by the way, how many fenders you need today, you see, or windshields or spark plugs or something like that. The next guy, he goes and he says, I see you got a new Buick. He knows that this guy loves Buicks. and it's what turns him on, and he talks about it, you see, or things like that. In the business world, we know these things. We know this is what counts. And yet in the church, what should be so obvious, we never do anything about it. I tell lay people this. What in the world makes you think that for 51 Sundays out of a year, you can hardly recognize a guy? At the most, you might wave at him and smile at him. Most of the time, we don't even do that. If we were asked to call his name, we couldn't. And then suddenly we go to him and say, will you be an elder? He has every right in the world to say, who are you? Who are you? I don't know anything about you. Because we just don't seem to care enough about people, you know. We just don't care enough about them. Pastor prays up there, you know, at the altar, and so, new baby. Wonder who that is. That's as much thought as we give to the whole business, you see. Oh, so-and-so died. Well, I wonder who they were. You see. Well, finally, it comes down to something the Lord, of course, said. And I guess that's what this all amounts to. We've got to care enough about people, love people enough, so we know something about them. And then maybe we'll do a better job of fitting them to this particular task. But you know, it's not getting done. It isn't getting done. We've got all of these mismatches going on. We even got the wrong system. We elect people, you see. And maybe that isn't the right way to do it. Maybe that isn't the right way to do it. Well, and then, of course, when we've made people, got people selected and matched them to the tasks as carefully as we can, then we've got to delegate the authority. And delegate authority so that it provides for growth. I wish now that I'd have brought a visual along, which I like to use too. It's a survey which the telephone company made. I'm sure you've probably seen it, Don. In which they tried to show what are the satisfiers and dissatisfiers. That's what they finally called it in industry. You know, all of the things that people complain about. We don't get enough salary. Or the girls in the office say, we'd work a lot better if you just pipe in music, you know, or paint the walls something else besides Concordia tan, that'll make us happier, and all the kinds of things like that. We find out that these things really don't count, or business found this out. These things really don't count. You give people a better salary, you give them music, you give them longer vacation periods and all of that. It helps for a while. It satisfies them, but it doesn't really do anything for their long term work. But what is it that makes them work harder and do a great job? Things like the job itself, doing a good job. We do have people yet who are interested in doing a good job for doing a good job's sake. I like to think that's what keeps a lot of women going in the house, you see. Here they make some pretty little dish of some kind with all kinds of little roses and all of that in. Spend hours and hours at it. They're proud of it, and in comes that hungry husband, that animal called a husband, and he just looks at it and sort of inhales it, and it's all gone, just like that. So it must be satisfaction in something, doing something well. But one of the greatest things they found was giving people responsibility. That was the biggest block, giving people responsibility. And now I've something to say about that in the church. Sometimes we think we know how to do that in the church, to give people responsibility, but we don't often give the authority that goes with that responsibility. I really think that if lay people would talk as openly with their pastors as they do with each other, they would probably say that the thing which displeases them most about working in the congregation, in a church, is that they think that the pastor never really ever trusts them to get the job done. He really never thinks they're going to get the job done. He will give them a responsibility, but somehow he doesn't really ever relinquish the authority that goes with it.
He's afraid they aren't going to get the job done, and so he's sort of standing around the edges, and he's going to meddle. That's what they'll say. And so finally, under this kind of a situation, there are a great many lay people who just finally figure, well, I'm not really interested in being the arms and legs of a pastor. I'm interested in being a servant for the Lord, but there's a difference. There's a difference. And their talents just aren't used. I go back to what I said earlier. I think we must really believe that in any congregation there are that number of people that God has given us to accomplish the tasks. The problem is we don't find them, we don't know them, we don't know how to use them. But they're there, and they do really want to work. And given the proper delegation and opportunity to grow, they will. They will. I was just thinking of something Don was saying about these surveys. I think of all of the young people in congregations who really want to do something. They really do want to do something. But we can only think of things like, come on Sunday afternoon and we'll take all of the gum off from underneath the pews. Or we'll get you together and you can patch the hymn books. Or stuff like that. And we have all of these little Mickey Mouse make-believe things that they know they're just being used because we can't think of anything else better. Or we really don't believe they can do anything better than that. But what if we would turn a survey over to them and they'd catch all of the people coming out of church some morning and say, we're interested in having a Sunday service, or we're interested in having a service other than Sunday. What would you be interested in? Or something like that. Construct a questionnaire like them and let them do it. Or how about on the other end, all of those old people that we talk about in the church, that we talk about having a ministry for them, when really we ought to be talking about having a ministry with them or by them. All of this great mass of experience and genuine usefulness that they have yet. They are the ones who ought to be doing some of these things in the church, you see. But we're content rather to put them in cages, as we always do in the church. We like to put people in categories and in boxes and then do something for them. And maybe have square dancing for them or something of the sort like that. And not really make them useful in the church. Well, and then a part of this organizing really is communicating effectively. And Don covered that very adequately in this short time. Nothing, of course, really works either. You can have all of the fine purposes and all of the fine planning and all of the fine organizing, but if you never communicate to each other, nothing happens either. And in the church, we use sometimes the poorest methods of communication that are possible. The sermon is one of the poorest methods of communicating. And that's what we use the most of. And outside of that, the bulletin. That poor old bulletin is supposed to carry more burdens than anything else. We aren't getting the money in. The stewardship people will say, put it in the bulletin, Pastor. And so we have all of these little notes in. Last Sunday we had so much money, we needed so much money. This Sunday we had this much money, we needed so much money. Now, I really don't think that's ever motivated anybody to give another dime, really. It's information, but it hasn't motivated anybody. Or the men's club said, well, put it in the bulletin, Pastor. What? Well, we're going to have a meeting next Wednesday night. And there now they've done their duty. And so here stands Jake outside the door on Wednesday evening and wrings his hand. Don't know why anybody doesn't come to our meetings. Put it in the bulletin. Don't know why they don't come. And he's never thought about the possibility that half the people never saw the bulletin and the other half never read it. You see. And besides, he's never said anything in the bulletin which would make anybody have any kind of a spark of interest for what they're doing. It's like the letter that Don read, you see. Come because we put a lot of work into it, boys. It was hard work, therefore you better appreciate it and come or else. That's about the way some of our invitations are, you see. So, we got to communicate. And then finally, the other principle is control, the last one. And this one, of course, we hardly ever exercise in the church because of two reasons. Control, of course, is well, we have to get a report from a person and we have to tell them either you did a good job or you didn't do a good job, and if you didn't get a good job, why, you ought to be removed. We hardly ever exercise this in the church for two reasons. One of the reasons is because we've never done any of this other stuff. First, this superintendent that we've gotten under the guise that it isn't much of a job. We haven't told him what his job is. He doesn't know what his goals are. We've never given him any help. So when he isn't doing his job, it's pretty difficult for us to go and say, Sam, you haven't done a very good job, and you ought to quit. We can't go to him because we're embarrassed. We've never told him what his job is. We've never helped him. We've never done anything. The other reason is because at this point, Christianity enters in. That is, well, some people's concept of Christianity. Guy doesn't do a good job, and now all at once, for the first time, we begin to think, oh, he's a brother in the faith. I can't tell him not to do that. He isn't doing a good job. How? What would I do? How would I react to something like this? I just can't do it. We'll just wait. We'll wait until his office runs out, until he dies, or something of the sort like that, you see. In reality, the better part of Christianity might be, in many instances, to finally say to a person, look, friend, you know what your job is. You know what you were supposed to do. We've tried to help you, but something isn't getting done. Is there anything we could be helping you with? And if he says no, then finally we have to say, but you can't stand in the way of getting the task done for the Lord. Therefore, we must ask you to step aside and let somebody else do it. And that needs to be done. And we don't often do it. We don't even do a good job of control insofar as the reporting process is concerned. You know, you've been to all of these meetings where the chairman of this congregation, you got a report? No report. No report? No report? No report. Half the time they don't report. The other time they read their report. Oh, our reporting process is pretty poor in the church many times. They either don't report or they report, they read what they're supposed to, or lots of times they spend 10 minutes telling you why they have no report. You know, they get up, George's reporting for the Board of Trustees. Well, we don't have a report tonight, but we'll have one next time. Sam is down in Florida visiting his son, and George went, he's in the hospital, you know, and Carl is over here doing something else. Now, one of these days we'll get together and we'll have a meeting and we'll make a report. And he spends you 10 minutes telling you why he hasn't got a report. And then there's one other poor devil in the congregation. That's the guy who never gets a chance to make a report. He's the guy who usually goes to such odd things as the old folks' home. You know, he's a representative to the Lutheran Charities or something like that. And he carries a big fat report in the back of his pocket. And he finally, at the end of the meeting, they say, Rudy, have you got your report ready? And he gets up and pulls that out. And then somebody says, well, we don't have time this time, Rudy. And when that happens, he isn't motivated to do very much either. Well, there, in a quick rundown, there are some of the management principles that we think ought to be effective in the church, sometimes aren't. Thank you.